Two out of three ain't bad. Good news from the war in Ukraine. Moscow and Kyiv agree to keep grain exports flowing. In Namibia, a win for LGBTQ rights. But in Ecuador, political chaos.
As of this morning, we're in the situation where we no longer have a Congress.
Also today on the show, in Sudan, it's a fight between two generals. One says he's protecting the people, but that is not the whole story.
I would argue that nobody has more blood on his hands in all of Sudan than Hameti.
Plus, the Arctic Council has been on ice for the past 2 years. Its members know that they need all the parties at the table.
Russia is half the Arctic, so you can't really, in good faith, have an Arctic Council without Russia. I mean, that just wouldn't make any sense.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could join us. Our first story today takes us out to sea. This video from the United Nations shows a boat speeding across the waters off Turkey. People on board are wearing orange life vests and safety helmets. They're part of an international team on their way to inspect a cargo ship. It is huge, longer than a football field, carrying corn, wheat, and sunflower oil from Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine are at war, but they agreed to observe a safe corridor for such grain exports beginning last July. That agreement was set to expire tomorrow, but some good news, it has been renewed. Joseph Glauber has followed the UN brokered negotiations for the Black Sea Grain Initiative. He's with the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington. Joseph, this UN brokered deal getting renewed is important. Remind us why these grain shipments from Russia and Ukraine are so crucial.
First, since Ukraine just plays such a large role in global markets, particularly for wheat, they're almost 10% of the world's market. They're a very large exporter of sunflower oil and a very large exporter of corn.
And a lot of countries depend on that. Now, the last time the agreement was set to expire back in March, Russia put off signing the renewal until the very last minute. Same thing this time. Why these delays?
What's remarkable is that, remember, this agreement is occurring during a time when we have an active war. And so I think it's unique in that respect, one way or the other. And so you have the conflict of the war that weighs over this. But the other thing is Russia has been trying to get some concessions on sanctions that they say are hampering their exports of fertilizer and food. There's also a pipeline that ships ammonia, a fertilizer component down from the Volga down to ports in the Black Sea. That's been blocked since the war. That's likely not to get reopened, but those have been demands that Russia has at least asked for in these renegotiations.
What countries or regions of the world are likely breathing a sigh of relief now that they know they'll be on the receiving end of this foodstuff?
Globally, any sort of supplies to the world is good news for everyone because prices will reflect the additional supplies. But their traditional buyers are countries in the Middle East and North Africa, particularly for wheat. But they also sell a lot of corn to Western Europe. They sell a lot of corn to China and a lot of wheat and other grains to countries in South Asia. So a lot of countries are directly affected. But again, everyone gains with lower prices.
When it comes to this Black Sea corridor for grain exports, which country's agricultural sector relies more on it? Is it Ukraine or Russia?
Well, right now, definitely Ukraine. Russia has been able to export a lot of its grain, despite the frictions they claim have occurred because of sanctions. They are likely having record exports this year for wheat. Ukraine, on the other hand, is very much limited. If it doesn't go out through the Black Sea, it has to go overland through Eastern Europe, and that comes at a very, very high cost in terms of higher transportation costs, and it's caused frictions with their neighbors to the west. So Poland and Slovakia, Hungary, others have raised concerns about Ukraine produce ending up in their backyard.
So what does Russia get out of this deal? Like, what's the motivation for them to even cooperate?
Well, goodwill. One, remember, there's a lot of countries that do benefit from this trade agreement. And many of those countries, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, places in the Middle East, others have been neutral, at least as far as the war with Ukraine is concerned. And so they stand to lose some goodwill by terminating that agreement. China, for example, which has supported Russia indirectly and certainly has been neutral insofar as the war itself is concerned, they have been a big beneficiary of this agreement, as have other countries in sub-Saharan Africa.
Joseph, 60 days from now, the deal expires again. What would be the consequences if the agreement were not renewed?
Well, we saw when they suspended the agreement back in November that grain prices, wheat prices rose by about 5%. I think that would be the most immediate effect. But the longer term effects of a blockage of grain out of the Black Sea is really felt by Ukraine. And I think already Ukraine production and exportable supplies are down almost 40% from where they were 2 years ago. And so this is the longer term concern if this Black Sea were closed to Ukraine exports.
Joseph Glauber, a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute, helping us understand the diplomacy around the deal known as the Black Sea Grain Initiative, renewed today. Joseph, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
In Sudan, street battles and airstrikes continue to put much of the population there at risk. Fighting began on April 15th. More than 600 people have been killed, hundreds of thousands forced to flee their homes. The United Nations says 25 million people need protection and humanitarian aid. Sadly, underscoring that need, a food factory in the Sudanese capital has burned down. The world's Shirin Jafari has more on that.
The Samil factory manufactured a life-saving product called RUTF. That stands for Ready-to-Use Therapeutic Food. It was invented by a French scientist 25 years ago, and it's used to treat severely malnourished children under the age of five.
It's a bit of a magic food because you do bring a child back from the brink of death.
James Elder is the spokesperson for UNICEF.
It's a dense energy paste. It's full of micronutrients and peanuts and sugar, powdered milk, vitamins, oil. It's got everything. It really does.
UNICEF worked with the Samil factory in Khartoum to procure the RUTF it needs to feed children in Sudan. Last Friday, news emerged that the factory burned down. Ella says he doesn't know who was behind it, whether it was a deliberate act or if it was just a consequence of the two sides fighting. What is clear, though, is that 15,000 boxes of the food were destroyed.
The factory that produces 60% of this ready-to-use therapeutic food for Sudanese children, 60%, that was burnt down. The production line, the machinery, all the ability to keep producing. So it was yet another blow for children that are under attack from so many different directions.
The UN estimates that millions of people are at risk of starvation in Sudan. Many have fled the country, but for those who remain, venturing out to get food could be dangerous. Banks have closed down and people are running out of cash. Elda says UNICEF now has to bring in the ready-to-use food from other countries, but the ongoing fighting makes this challenging.
This was already a cruel place for millions and millions of children. It just got that more difficult.
The loss of the Samil factory is part of a pattern of destruction of food supplies that makes life for residents so difficult that they decide to leave. On Monday, aerial footage showed a large fire in a market on the outskirts of Khartoum. And in the initial days of the fighting, the World Food Programme said its warehouses were looted. More than $13 million worth of food was taken.
Yeah, I'm still on the road, but if a connection is okay.
I reached Eugene Bayon from the United Nations Refugee Agency in Chad. Chad is where a lot of the Sudanese have fled in recent days. Bayon's car had a flat tire and the connection didn't hold up. But later, in a series of WhatsApp messages, she described the dire situation that she's seeing now.
We're looking at 25 to 30,000 refugees crossing the border last few days.
More than 90% of them are women and children, she says.
We see a lot of children crossing the border by themselves. We see a lot of orphans without a relative, without their parents crossing the border. It is indeed a children's crisis.
UNICEF says that nearly 200 children were killed, caught in the crossfire in the early days of the fighting in Sudan. Now, with the news about the only factory making food for severely malnourished children out of operation, fears are growing about the survival of millions of others. A spokesperson for UNICEF says that timing is crucial. Supplies must arrive fast. If that doesn't happen, hunger will threaten the lives of many Sudanese children. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
One side of the conflict in Sudan is led by the warlord known as Hemeti. Later this hour on the show, we look at how he's evaded accusations of atrocities for almost 20 years. Inside the Supreme Court of Namibia today, Celebration there after the court ruled in favor of recognizing same-sex marriages if the union was made official outside the country. The ruling comes as LGBTQ rights are under attack in many other parts of Africa. Joining us to discuss this is Omar Van Rienen. He's an LGBTQ activist with the Namibia Equal Rights Movement. He's in neighboring Botswana today. Omar, your immediate reaction to today's ruling by Namibia Supreme Court.
This is such a wonderful ruling and verdict that we received on the eve of the International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia. But for many queer Namibians who are waking up today, what a time it is to be alive and to be queer and here. This has been almost a six-year battle for the litigants, but really a 20-year battle to overturn a damaging ruling in the Frank case in 2001 that didn't recognize our humanity and our equal worth in the Namibian society.
As I said today, you're in neighboring Botswana at an LGBTQ rights conference. What's the mood there in light of this news?
Oh, it's fantastic. This conference is a gathering of LGBTQ activists from across the continent. And at a time when state-sanctioned homophobia is running rampant in our neighboring countries like Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania, it looked bleak for our movement and it looked bleak for the future of queer persons in Africa. But a ruling like this really affirms the strength that we have in community and the strength that we have by using visibility as our greatest weapon against state-sanctioned homophobic politicians and policies.
Right. Today's ruling impacts people who were married outside Namibia. Where does the right of LGBTQ couples to be legally partnered in Namibia, where does that stand today?
So the ruling right now just recognizes same-sex marriages that are concluded in foreign jurisdictions. So South Africa is the only country in Africa that allows same-sex marriages. So many Namibians would have to travel to South Africa to take part in this marriage, but now coming back to Namibia, they are seen as a family and they are recognized and their marriage is respected as well. So now it's up to our elected representatives and the members of parliament to match what the Supreme Court has said and to offer Namibians a pathway to marry domestically. So, you know, unfortunately, our members of parliament, especially some of our ministries, have shown that they don't have the political will to legislate appropriately. So it's going to be up to the community and up to the activists to hold our government accountable and to make sure our government respects the Supreme Court's ruling. And in the ruling, the Supreme Court has instructed Parliament to make sure that Namibia's marriages are consistent with the Constitution.
Right. How significant would you say this is all for LGBTQ rights across Africa, especially when in places like Uganda, harsh anti-LGBTQ laws are being passed? Also, Ghana has considered such laws as well. Will Namibia be seen in some parts of the continent as a leader?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, even here right now, this regional gathering, Namibia is seen as a beacon of hope. And then regionally and continentally, it does set like soft law and it does set precedents, especially in regional bodies like the African Union and the Southern African Development Community and in their tribunal courts. So this does set sound precedent and it can be used as a soft law and it can push many other countries like Botswana or Angola to start recognizing same-sex unions as well.
Omar Van Rienen is an LGBTQ activist with the Namibia Equal Rights Movement. He joined us from Botswana today. Omar, thanks very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Ecuador's president is on trial for impeachment. Then he disbanded parliament. We have the latest just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Here's something that suggests a democracy ain't working as it should. A president can't get along with a legislature that is stacked with his political opponents, so the president just shuts them down. That's what happened in Ecuador. President Guillermo Lasso had been facing impeachment proceedings over accusations of embezzlement, so he took the unprecedented step of dissolving the country's National Assembly. Carolina Loza Leon is a journalist based in Ecuador's capital, Quito. Carolina, President Lasso is calling this move a muerte cruzada, mutual death. That sounds really drastic. Why is he calling this mutual death?
It is one of the last resort tools that President Lasso had. I mean, there has been several efforts to remove him from office. And with the impeachment charges and the impeachment trial that started yesterday, there was very little that he could do to survive this. And as of this morning, we're in this situation where we no longer have a Congress.
With the dissolution of the National Assembly, what happens to the impeachment proceedings now? Are they on hold?
Basically, they dissolve Congress and they're going to call for elections in 6 months' time. So it's a new assembly. It's basically starting over. But it comes at a time where Ecuadorians are also fed up from a wide array of corruption scandals from some of the people working in Congress. So there has been an erosion of the trust people had in Congress. And it comes at a time that could play well for Lasso.
I mean, this is an unprecedented move. What's been the reaction, first of all, from the opposition politicians?
They have been mentioning going up to the Constitutional Court to present this as an unconstitutional move. So that's ongoing right now. Also, the indigenous nationalities and the party from the indigenous party here, Pachakutik, would be a big indicator. But right now, everyone's on hold. The news took everyone by surprise this morning in Ecuador. And the automatic response from people was some fear that they would start protests. Some of the protests that have taken place in the past few years have shown that it can get quite violent and put the country to a halt. So there's heavy military presence around key buildings like the presidential palace and Congress, where everyone was, no one is allowed in, and the military is there.
Now, the opposition to Lasso holds a majority in the parliament. How are Ecuadorians responding?
Well, Lasso's popularity has been plummeting, and there's the ongoing crisis when it comes to crime and drug trafficking groups fighting for territory. And we got to remember, some of the opposition right now that were leading this impeachment were people from a party close to Lasso before he took office. So it could go either way.
The dissolution of the assembly is a constitutional provision in Ecuador, but it's never happened before in Ecuadorian history. Is it going to hold up in court?
It's up to the constitutional court, but it comes at a time where people are really trying to find a way out. There's high levels of unemployment. And this security crisis that's really affecting people in their everyday lives. So, of course, it's a blow to democracy to have a president rule by decree and with the support of the armed forces.
You said this process is supposed to conclude in 6 months with elections. How long can Lasso lead without a legislature, especially with these embezzlement charges hanging over him?
One key here is the military. The military would play a crucial role for him to be able to stay in power. So it is going to be quite a fragile period for him if he can hold on to those 6 months, if there's not a maneuver by the opposition to remove him from office earlier. It is quite a stark scenario to see if he can hold up for those 6 months. It's up to the support that he can get from the armed forces pretty much now.
Carolina Loza Leon is a journalist based in Quito, Ecuador, speaking with us about the decision taken today by Ecuador's president to dissolve the country's parliament. Carolina, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The Arctic Council, 8 countries that have territory in the Arctic. They work together on things that impact the entire area. Norway has now taken leadership of the Arctic Council. For the past 2 years, the rotating chairmanship had been in Russia's hands. That caused the council to break down. The world's Anna Kusma reports on the council's precarious future.
Russia took over leadership of the Arctic Council in 2021.
Dear Excellencies, distinguished guests and friends of the Arctic.
Chair of senior Arctic officials Nikolai Korchinov said his priorities were environmental protection and economic development.
The Arctic is without a doubt marked by rapid change, but it's important to also stress that it is full of resilience and that it is a promising stage for new opportunity.
But less than a year into his tenure,
dawn in a European capital. A missile hits a block of flats.
Russia invaded its neighbor Ukraine, and for the first time ever, the 7 other Arctic Council countries stopped attending meetings, putting them completely on hold.
The 7 other states, they literally stood up and walked away from the table, leaving Russia by itself.
Rasmus Bertelsen is a professor of Northern Studies at the Arctic University of Norway. He says what happens down south has always had a direct impact up north.
In my view, the Arctic usually closely reflects the international system.
Bertelsen says the council has been on ice to avoid it breaking down altogether.
I have likened it to putting a patient in coma to save the patient.
Now the question is whether Norway can resuscitate it and keep Russia engaged. Julie Gorley is a former senior Arctic official with the U.S.
Russia is half the Arctic, so you can't really in good faith have an Arctic Council without Russia. I mean, that just wouldn't make any sense.
Gourley says Russian attendance has always been spotty, and that will likely continue. But some participation is better than none. The Council makes crucial decisions about development in the Arctic and environmental protection. It needs Russia to share information and climate data.
We have to find ways to engage them that are not going to hand Russia any kind of victories, but that will still get the bare minimum that we need from the Russian part of the equation.
Six of the seven other member countries belong to NATO, and they all have sanctions against Russia. But Gourley thinks that as Russia's longtime neighbor, Norway is in a good position to walk the diplomatic knife's edge.
I'm quite certain that Norway is going to find a way to work with Russia that doesn't run afoul of the sanctions regime, but that ensures that the critical work gets back on track again.
And the stakes are highest for residents of the Arctic, particularly indigenous groups who are permanent participants on the council but don't have voting rights and didn't have a say in the decision to pause work while Russia was in charge. Sarah Olsvi is international chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council. She says when meetings were paused, indigenous people lost a place to weigh in on important issues.
We saw that there was a risk that we would be pushed to the side in the decision-making processes.
Climate change is having an outsized impact on the Arctic, says Olsvi. So a two-year pause has been a serious setback.
Protecting the Arctic is to protect the planet. And we are seeing changes in the ecosystems affecting biodiversity in our own homelands, both on land and in sea, as we speak. So for us, it is very, very real.
Olsvi says critical working groups on managing fisheries, forest fires, and climate change adaptation have been sidelined. Getting these back on track will be a major challenge.
I don't think we can safely say that that the Arctic Council is out of the woods. Nothing will be back in business as usual for the time being.
Norway has signaled its commitment to restart the Council's work while maintaining its stance against the war. In an official statement, Norway's foreign minister said, quote, "Political contact with Russia is not possible, but we will continue to be predictable in our dealings with Russia in the Arctic Council." For The World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
Mumbai, India, a megacity that generates an astonishing amount of trash. But thanks to an informal network of recycling scavengers, the city is livable and produces high rates of recycling. The life of plastic never ends, says this man sorting through plastic ice cream cartons. Mumbai's chaotic yet effective recycling program, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Sudan, two generals are battling for control. Both rose up through the ranks doing the bidding of an autocratic president. One heads up Sudan's armed forces, the other the feared Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. That would be Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known as Hameti. It means Little Mohamed, his childhood nickname. The World's Chris Harlan Dunaway reports on a man who is anything but little.
There's something that sets Hameti apart from everyone who's been jockeying for power in Sudan.
I would argue that nobody has more blood on his hands in all of Sudan than Hameti.
That's Eric Reeves, an author and lecturer on Sudan. He's testified in front of the U.S. Congress about the country. And there aren't a lot of people who followed Hameti's life more closely, all the way back to his first job.
Some call him a camel trader, but most who know him say he was nothing more than a camel thief.
Hameti's early years are a bit fuzzy. He struggled in school and lived way out in the arid scrub of Sudan in a place that was about to change forever.
An estimated 10,000 people have been killed and more than a million driven from their homes in a brutal 16-month conflict in the region of Darfur in western Sudan.
The president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, was trying to stamp out what he called the insurgency in Darfur. At the time, Hameti was a fighter in a militia called the Janjaweed. Apparently, he had talent.
It's extraordinary that a third-grade dropout should rise to become a commander in the Darfur genocide.
Hameti followed the president's orders, no matter how ruthless.
Bashir essentially said, let's wipe them out, the rebels. But that also meant wiping out the people.
It's been unclear what Hameti's exact role was, whether he was on the scene of the atrocities or in some office command center somewhere. Unaware. Workers in a refugee camp connected us with several survivors of violent attacks on villages in Darfur. Though we couldn't record their voices, they were eager to speak. In each account, Hamedi was there, in person, directing the killing. One woman, a mother of six, said through a translator that Hamedi walked through a village in his green head wrap, lifted his AK-47, and shot villagers himself. One survivor remembers him yelling, "Clean the land of these black insects." And here's the thing. The International Criminal Court could have prosecuted him. So how come no one stopped Hamedi? Many wanted to.
I am Luis Moreno Ocampo. I was the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court.
The International Criminal Court, which is based in The Hague, prosecutes genocide and crimes against humanity. In 2009, Ocampo indicted President al-Bashir, two government ministers, and a Janjaweed commander. But lots of people, like Hamedi, weren't indicted. In fact, Hamedi was in the crosshairs of the court as far back as 2003. In an annex filed with the indictment, the prosecutor says Hamedi went to al-Bashir's house at least twice for instructions in the genocidal campaign in Darfur. So why didn't Ocampo go further with his investigations and prosecute more cases? He says meaningful help from any country was hard to come by. As one ambassador put it privately,
"My country wants to be sure that you know we will continue providing lip services to your job."
Ocampo wanted help pressuring the Sudanese to let his investigators into the country and protect witnesses, but not even the U.S., which had just helped broker a peace agreement with Sudan that created South Sudan, was willing to help. Eventually, an official from the U.S. National Security Council told Ocampo why they wouldn't.
"Our agenda in Sudan is not just about Darfur. It's about support in the war on terror. We need Sudan helping us to collect information. And it's also respect for this independence of the South of Sudan. So your agenda, unique on Darfur, is complicated for us."
We asked the National Security Council for comment, but they didn't respond to our requests. After talking about all the ways in which his work had been blocked, I put this question to Ocampo.
What does the international community do about impunity? Is it all about building a consensus to stop people like this?
International community is like a unicorn. You can see pictures, but the animal does not exist, okay? You know the game Fortnite? Fortnite is a game very popular where 100 players play and the winner kills all the others. That is the model of the world today. The problem is not Hamedi. The problem is Hamedi is the normal consequence of the system.
A former National Security Council official agreed. He told me powerful outsiders had little interest in shaking things up. Each had their own interests at stake. Russia was getting gold from Sudan and eyeing a new naval base on the coast. China needed Sudan's oil. And Washington wanted Khartoum on board to assist with counterterrorism efforts in the region and to preserve a fragile peace with South Sudan. It seems the countries that could have tried to get Sudan to turn over evidence of war crimes and maybe war criminals themselves didn't exercise that power. Hamedi, who led forces that committed war crimes and who witnesses say he took part in himself, not only walked free, he prospered. For the world, I'm Chris Harlan Dunaway.
Tomorrow, part two, the story of how Hamedi rose to be one of the most powerful men in Sudan and made millions. The pandemic may no longer be a global health emergency, but disease experts are already thinking about the next one. Concern is growing, especially around what could happen as human populations continue to encroach on once remote areas that are home to bats. An investigation by Reuters identified so-called jump zones across more than 100 countries. In other words, areas with heightened risk for bat-borne diseases spilling over into human populations. Dr. Neil Vora has studied this. He's a physician and pandemic prevention fellow at Conservation International. Let's start with the basics, Dr. Vora. This term spillover, what does that mean exactly, and what happens when there is a spillover?
It's important to recognize that most existing infectious diseases originate in animals, and the germs that cause those infectious diseases have jumped over into people. And so that jumping is what is known as spillover.
And what's the concern about humans in contact with bats in particular?
Well, we know that over the last few decades, these spillovers are on the rise. And one of the sources for some of these very dangerous infectious diseases are bats. And that's why they've received a lot of attention.
Haven't humans always lived in close contact with bats?
That's right. We interact with wildlife in a variety of ways, whether intentionally or not. Those wildlife animals include bats as well. So it's really important, though, that we can respect and admire bats, but that we do so from a safe distance unless we have the proper training and equipment to interact with them directly.
So what kinds of diseases come from bats? Or are there diseases we don't even know about yet?
There's a lot of different infectious diseases that can come from bats, everything from rabies. In the United States, one of the biggest risks for acquiring rabies does come from bats. But in other parts of the world, there are other diseases that can be acquired from bats, including Marburg virus, which is a cousin of Ebola. Ebola also probably originates from bats. And many coronaviruses have also been identified in bats, some of which can infect people, including the original SARS coronavirus, very likely MERS coronavirus, and also very likely the virus that causes COVID-2 ultimately originated from bats.
So I'm guessing a lot of the concern is not just about the growth of numbers of humans in areas that are bat habitats. It's also got to be about the resources that get consumed when that population grows. So what role does habitat destruction play in increasing risk of disease spillover?
The research shows that human activities are a large reason why we are seeing spillovers increasingly occur. Human activities that place humans increasingly in contact with wildlife, these activities include everything from habitat destruction, particularly in the form of deforestation, but also wildlife trade, both legal and illegal, farming under unsafe conditions where there's not good infection control, and also climate change. There's growing research that shows that human activities that drive climate change are also pushing reservoirs of disease closer to humans as these disease reservoirs, meaning wildlife, look for more favorable habitats for their survival.
Dr. Vora, I know that bats are one of the oldest mammal species on the planet. Like, their DNA was pretty much locked down millions of years ago, very little variation since then. Do you know what it is exactly about bats that makes them ideal hosts for all these potentially nasty diseases?
There's a variety of different reasons why bats can be hosts for a number of different pathogens. Their immune systems that are different than human immune systems make them less susceptible to some of the diseases that we are highly vulnerable to. Another reason might be the ability of bats to fly over large distances. One thing I also want to make very clear is that even though this is a scary conversation and we're talking about deadly infectious diseases, we cannot leave this conversation thinking that bats are bad, that we should be killing all the bats. Bats provide many important services to people as well. For example, bats are important pollinators for plants that we rely upon. Bats are also very important animals for controlling insect populations, and insects themselves can spread diseases as well. So all organisms on this planet are living in a very delicate equilibrium, and when we disrupt one part of that equilibrium, it has downstream effects that can then lead to these adverse outcomes such as outbreaks.
Dr. Neil Vora is a physician and pandemic prevention fellow at Conservation International. He joined us from New York. Dr. Vora, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
A quick warning, some listeners may find details in this next report upsetting. The disgraced internet personality Andrew Tate is under house arrest in Romania, facing charges including human trafficking and rape. He denies the allegations, but his story has focused attention on Romania's adult webcam industry, which employs thousands of women. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry went to find out more and has this report from the Romanian capital.
Okay, let me take you to some rooms.
Maria Borghina, a former webcam model, is taking me on a tour of Best Studios. It's one of the largest webcam businesses in Bucharest.
How many rooms is there?
Right now we have 16 rooms.
16, 1-6?
6-0.
Each of the rooms is decorated differently. One is painted gold and white, another is all decked out in pink. But in the centre of all of them is a large double bed, facing a tripod with a video camera on it. Borghina, who's now marketing manager for the webcam company, says she advises the women to keep their clothes on for as long as possible.
We are a studio where models, they do get naked, but they are more into conversation.
But do most of your members still get naked during the conversation?
Yes, like 99% of the time the models are asked to get naked.
Most of the clientele is based in the United States and pay anything from $1 to $10 a minute. At one point, we walk into a large room full of men sitting behind a long row of computers. It looks kind of like a call centre. What is this room with all the computers?
These are the trainers.
How do you mean?
The trainers for the models. Oh. They do train the models.
So the model is in the room and the trainer is out here watching and listening everything that's...
It's about watching all the time the model, then type for the model.
Borregina says it's the men at the computers who are often typing messages to the customers online.
Because who understands better a man than another man?
Borregina says some for top-earning models make up to $50,000 a month and they attract the models to apply for work with online ads. But anti-sex trafficking campaigners say a lot of webcam bosses work differently. They use what's known as the loverboy method to recruit young women and girls.
I hate we have to call it loverboy because I think we are twisting, you know, the term love. But this is what they're using, you know. It's what still works the best.
This is Monica Bosef. Her organisation, the Open Door Foundation in Bucharest, works with victims of sex trafficking. She tells me many of the women her group supports were lured into the trade by men pretending to be in love with them. And she says many of the women started out in the webcam business. The controversial influencer Andrew Tate once said more than half of the 75 women working for his webcam company started out as his girlfriends. And some of those that Tate is alleged to have targeted were teenagers.
It was very obvious we were high school girls, like we had their high school, like in our bio and everything.
That's Daria Gusa speaking to the BBC recently. She says Tate messaged her on Instagram when she was just 16. Gusa ignored his messages, but says Tate also sent private messages to some of her high school friends, who did respond.
I feel like he was just trying to find girls that seemed as like innocent or naive as possible, in my opinion.
Last month, a law firm representing three women who worked as webcam models for Tate in London said it's planning to take out a lawsuit against him. The women are accusing him of abuse and rape. One of the women spoke to Matt Shea, a reporter with Vice News. She didn't want her identity revealed.
First night that I worked for him, Andrew bought me like 5 bottles of wine. So I got completely drunk because I'd never done webcam work. Then that night, we were just sitting on the bed and Andrew punched me.
Were there any other instances where there was physical abuse?
He used to strangle us as well.
Tate has denied all the allegations. Technically, adult webcam work is legal in Romania as long as there's no violence and performers appear in front of the camera alone. But in some cases, women are coerced or forced into meeting clients in person. Silvia Tobușcă is a law professor and human rights expert in Bucharest.
They are threatened with different videos that are taken by the companies in order to meet real clients and to prostitute themselves.
Tobușcă says she knows women who met with clients because they were terrified that videos of them performing online would be released publicly. She tells me about two girls who worked in a webcam studio in Bacău in eastern Romania.
One of them told me that they've been forced to accept to meet some clients in Dubai. And going in Dubai, they've been effectively tortured for a week.
Tobușcă says those young women were too frightened to go to the police. Back at Best Studios, Maria Borregina says she wants to see better regulation of the webcam industry. She says that will rule out some of the exploitation that goes on. Everyone who works in her studio, she assures me, is there of their own free will. But none of the women agree to talk with me. Later I ask anti-sex trafficking campaigner Monica Bosef what she thinks when she hears webcam bosses say that women choose to do this work.
If it's such a desirable profession, why aren't they training their own children to become one? It's because you know exactly what it does to the human body, mind and soul.
Bolsev says the arrest of Andrew Tate has raised awareness of the abuse of women within the webcam industry in Romania, but she says little has been done by the authorities to tackle it. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Bucharest, Romania.
India is now a country of 1.4 billion people. To state the obvious, a population that big generates a lot of waste, a big problem India has grappled with for a long time. Central to its waste management efforts are millions of waste pickers. Yesterday, we told you about people who scavenge through trash in Ghana. Today, we continue our focus looking at India. Waste pickers there are some of the most marginalized people in society, but without them, recycling would come to a standstill. Namratha Kolachlam reports from Mumbai on this overlooked but essential community.
I'm standing in Dharavi, considered one of the world's largest slums and home to 1 million people. Though overcrowded, chaotic, and mostly lacking modern sanitation, in fact, Dharavi has a $1 billion annual economy driven by thousands of entrepreneurial shops and factories. And tucked into its narrow and twisty lanes is the heart of Mumbai's recycling operation. As you walk past tin-roofed shacks, there are ordered stacks of other people's garbage everywhere. People are transforming what once were soda cans into motor parts for small appliances and melting shiny pieces of plastic into kids' toys. A quarter of the people living here are employed in recycling, giving new life to an estimated 60% of the city's plastic. A recycling rate far higher than in the U.S.
The life of plastic never ends. It breaks, then in a month or so, it comes back as another thing.
That's Ali Mohammed. He sorts through a mountain of plastic ice cream cartons that are destined to become anything from hair combs to water buckets. In a city staggering under the amount of garbage discarded each day, waste pickers help make the metropolis of 20 million people livable. And for every bottle and bag collected, that's less plastic that ends up in the ocean. So, how does the operation work? To find out, I head to the affluent neighborhood of Bandra. In Bandra, I meet a skinny man in his 40s, wearing a Captain America t-shirt and camo hat. This is Sheikh Salim. He sets down the enormous bag he's carrying and shows me the litter he's collected while walking down this busy street.
There is paper, these are bottles, this is a metal container, a thin sheet of plastic. I will take this waste to the scrap dealer who will weigh it, and whatever 150 rupees I will get.
The dealers then send it to the small-scale recyclers back in Dharavi.
There's a formal system of management, there's an informal system of management, and that's where the chaos is.
That's Swati Singh Sambyal, a waste management expert based in Delhi. She says on the positive side, there's growing awareness in India about the importance of scientifically managing trash. In 2016, the government decreed that all Indians must segregate their trash at the household level. So each home should separate dry waste, wet waste, and hazardous waste. But many households don't. Instead, they might toss plastic water bottles in with food scraps and diapers. And Sambyal notes that even when families do separate their trash, the city garbage collectors often toss it all together.
Perhaps if I'm doing it as a resident, it's being collected and then mixed and then, say, going to a facility where it's burnt.
Or the municipal sanitation trucks might just dump everything into landfills, she says, which other waste pickers then dig through, which is dangerous work.
Me segregating then goes down the drain.
Sambyal says the challenge is making them part of the city's waste management system.
How do we formalize the informal sector? Or if we're not able to do so, how do we bring them into our processes?
It's a good question, and it's one that Sushila Sable is also asking. She's part of a women's empowerment group in Mumbai called Sri Mukti Sangatana. For decades, she gathered recyclables from a nearby dumping ground, a hazardous job. Sable says it's high time that their work be officially recognized for the important role they play.
From the year 2008, we have been demanding that we be given an identity card to be recognized and live a life as humane as possible given the circumstances we work in. But till now, we have not got the identity card.
Having this official ID helps protect them from police harassing them, reduces the stigma of the job, and could help them access subsidized housing, healthcare, and education for their kids. The good news is, some cities have already begun to incorporate waste pickers into the waste management system. For instance, the city of Ambikapur in the state of Chhattisgarh has given several hundred waste pickers ID cards so they can collect garbage from people's homes where it's been pre-sorted. Later, the dry waste will be separated into a whopping 156 different items.
The idea is that the more we segregate, the more revenue we earn.
That's Ritesh Saini, the official officer for the country's Clean India mission, Swachh Bharat. He's based within the city government. Saini gives the example of an average water bottle.
The cap is separated, the plastic wrapper is separated, and the bottle body is separated.
By selling each piece to a different vendor, he says, the city generates a lot more income. Back in Dharavi, Ali Mohammed says business is booming for recyclers like him, as Indians throw away more trash than ever. In fact, the Indian government predicts that the country's plastic use will more than triple in the next decade. It's a big reason why waste pickers are asking for more protection and recognition for their role in waste management. Sushila Sable, the former waste picker in Mumbai, who now works organizing them, says,
"We work for the cleanliness of the surrounding living spaces as well as protecting the environment. Slowly, the world is recognizing us and our role."
For The World, I'm Namrata Kalachalam in Mumbai.
Tomorrow, our series about people who work with trash takes us to Colombia, where waste pickers organized to get official status as city workers. We conclude today with news of a rare sighting in Israel. An endangered monk seal has been spotted sunbathing in Tel Aviv. TV cameras staked out the rocky shore to capture the occurrence on what was apparently a very slow news day.
Marine scientists have been waiting actually for over a decade to witness the Mediterranean monk seal on the shores of Israel. Over here you can see she is resting now.
Marine rangers say she's molting, shedding her winter coat to get ready for summer. New coat, new name.
The boy who found her called her Yulia. In 2007, she was observed in Turkey, and there they called her Tugra. So now she has two names.
There was a time long ago when the Mediterranean Sea was teeming with hundreds of thousands of monk seals. That's what a monk seal sounds like. You're welcome. These days, just 300 or so Mediterranean monk seals remain, so a molting monk seal taking a sunbath. You are keeping hope alive for us today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.